Australia is a very important, has very important ambitions within the sustainability agenda, the 2035, 2050. Biodiversity is a big contributor to that. And therefore, what the government, can the government do to catalyze biodiversity regeneration or mitigate the loss that's going on? And will it have developments for things like battery storage, for example?
Hello and welcome back to The Green Away. I'm your host, Jamie Williamson, and today we're talking batteries and biodiversity with Gresham House Chief Executive Tony Dalwood. For those who may not be familiar, Gresham House is a UK-based funds manager specialising in sustainable alternatives, including energy transition infrastructure and other sustainable infrastructure investments, as well as forestry. And Gresham has been in Australia recently to meet with super funds and other institutions about a variety of opportunities, namely batteries and battery storage. Firstly, Tony, thank you so much for joining us on The Green Away.
Good to be here, Jamie. Thank you.
Now, you first started investing in batteries about 7 years ago, and you've now grown that capability to the point of having a fund open to institutional investors, the Gresham House Energy Storage Fund. As mentioned, you're in Australia with your battery team to provide advice to Australian asset owners. What are you telling them and what are you hearing from them?
Well, that's a lot. That could be here for a while talking about that. I think the key point is this is our second fund. We actually launched the first funds accessible to retail institutional wealth management in the UK about 7-8 years ago. That's on the London Stock Exchange. So we've had a lot of experience in battery energy storage utility scale. And what we've learned from that, I think the biggest point is what we've learned from that are things that can then be talked about with institutional investors as we come onto our first private fund in this space and a global one at that. So as you say, I've been around with my international team in Australia as well as New Zealand in the last week or so. I think the key points are the learnings. The fact that we have been in this space for 7-8 years, the fact that we have learned a lot around how to do contracting, around planning and execution of the projects, the relationships with grid, wherever they may be within the world, the respective grids. And packaging institutional capital into something that's investable for a long-term investor is important. But I think the secondary point, and probably a crucial one, is that over the last 7 or 8 years, batteries and the recognition that battery energy storage is intrinsic to in order to manage renewables on the grid. Australia is 70% renewable energy. The UK is 40% now. If you go back 10 years, it's next to zero, very close to zero. And so you've got a significant portion of people learning about how to manage the grid with this new wave of generation. And we have those learnings. We have that ability to put that into practice and keep evolving. And I think those aspects differentiate us as we have an institutional proposition for the global market. And those institutions which are still very keen on moving towards net zero, but making a fundamental return on capital, good return on capital, but not necessarily one that requires government intervention.
You kind of already touched on the UK and how progressed it is in this space, but it is often considered to be at least sort of 5 years ahead of the rest of the world on energy storage as an asset class. Why do you think this is?
I mean, I suppose it's a bit like sports. The UK seems to invent sports and then become secondary in terms of quality compared to the rest of the world as they overtake and win. But I hope that's not the case necessarily in battery storage. But we bought a business about 8 years ago that had seen the potential for battery storage and managing storage on the grid in the UK. We warehoused some of that on our balance sheet at the first project. We then used that as a learning mechanism for launching our longer term fund that we've got on the London Stock Exchange. The future recognition that you do need in order to make returns from renewables, it's very clear that you do need storage to be part of that solution. The returns on renewables themselves have come down immeasurably. The recognition that you actually have significant amount of negative pricing on electricity during a day or during a month and so on means that you do have an opportunity from storage in order to hedge some of the fact that you do have negative pricing just on solar and wind. And so the co-location is relevant, but batteries themselves in a tried and tested way, because if you go back 5 years, people were talking about other types of storage capabilities like hydrogen. We were always under the impression that hydrogen was, one, not commercially viable at that stage and it was very costly and may not be the most appropriate thing to use, but because it was earlier in its evolution. Whereas lithium ion batteries, which is the core part of our generation or our storage, is one which has been tested for tens of years is actually increasingly gets cheaper every 2 or 3 years. It halves in price effectively. So you've got a situation where there's much lower risk on tried and tested technology. And that is something that we, our education, we spend a lot of time educating investors about how to make returns from renewable energy, storage, natural capital. And that culture within Gresham House is one which you have to have as an institutional investor if you're going into these new areas of institutional investment. You go back 25 years, the average asset allocation to private equity was zero. It's now 5 to 10 to 15, depending where you are, but there's certainly something. And that period of education 25 years ago took a few years, but now people are quite sophisticated. They want mega buyouts. They want healthcare buyouts. They want venture capital. They want mezzanine. And those things, with that sophistication, is as people become more familiar with the asset class. We believe that will happen with energy transition. We also believe that will happen with natural capital as well.
We know that earlier this year, for instance, the capacity investment scheme in Australia was expanded by 25%. That was welcomed by local institutions like HESTA. But does storage capability in Australia require further federal help to ensure that Australia can meet its emissions reductions targets? And are there any roadblocks to capital deployment?
So the two points to make. One is the critical areas, the planning, the ability to get planning for renewables and battery storage is one that we know is very relevant in the UK and in Ireland. Does it require subsidies? Not necessarily, no. We believe we've got a system in the UK, and the assets we have don't require subsidy at all. I think the future requires that the government and planning is the focus. I don't think there is needs to be an involvement beyond that, really.
I want to switch gears a little bit now, because I want to talk a little bit more about forestry, which is also a big part of what Gresham House does. How does your work with forestry in Tasmania help your engagement with the local market?
Well, having resources on the ground, people feel much more comforted. We are increasingly resourcing up on the ground, and we've got people based in Geelong, and increasingly we'll be putting people in Tas as well. And I do expect us to continue to invest in Australia. So it gives people and investors comfort that you're close to the assets that you're managing. So that's critical. I think the other aspect, back to the point I meant earlier, is because this is an evolving asset class, the education of investors is critical. And so as you get more projects, more case studies, more track records, people are able to get more familiar, more comfortable on how to value that risk that they are, what they're doing with giving you capital. So all of that goes towards a package of explaining to investors how they can make capital returns, but also how they can qualify that risk. And hopefully, because they've got more case studies and track records, it's a lower risk assessment.
Do you find that there is still a bit of reluctance from maybe the super funds or whatever, or hesitance around investing in forestry?
Yeah, there's certainly some are receptive because they're beginning to recognise the natural capital is an asset class, as I say, will come up on the agenda over time. And I expect in 10 years it to be an allocation. We're seeing that in the UK. Big investors going, right, I've got zero in natural capital, but I'm now making it an asset allocation piece. And I believe that's coming here as well. There's a lot of rhetoric, no matter what size of supers talk to, who want to talk about natural capital. And a big part of natural capital is forestry. And our assessment is going to be probably a significant 50-odd percent of any natural capital allocation will be of a forestry order. So we do see supers who were hesitant previously, hesitant around, can they make the returns they need? People are looking for double digit most of the time, and therefore you've got to put on expectations or assumptions around carbon, biodiversity, and all other things beyond simply the harvesting of trees. But if you look at the case for forestry, and you recognise that there is an insufficient supply of housing, which I don't think anybody debates, you need more wood and timber to go as part of those housing. So you know the demand supply dynamic is very positive. 50% of wood in the UK goes to housing. So such a substantial portion. So the more demand for housing, which we know there is, the more wood that's required. Australia is a net importer of wood, very significant. Therefore, security of supply of wood, or you try to become more self-sufficient. The UK is 80% importer of wood that it uses. And these sort of significances we used to take for granted, but with the geopolitical changes we've had in the last few years, the recognition that you can't just carry on the way you were, particularly things like oil supply.
Yeah.
People recognize now that maybe they took for granted that peacetime dividend, let's call it.
You also run a biodiversity fund in the UK with Willis Towers Watson as the lead investor. Do you see a similar opportunity for Australia?
Certainly. I mean, if you are a believer in the long-term sustainability themes and characteristics, biodiversity is another part of regeneration and sustainability. The governments of the world are running out of money to spend. Therefore, can you come up with something that is a supply-side reform to encourage regeneration of, in this case, biodiversity, or other cases, is carbon sequestration? This is a great thing the government in the UK done. I do believe there are learnings for Australia, certainly. In the UK, the Environment Act of 2021 meant that it was mandatory to offset your biodiversity loss when you develop buildings or houses. So that loss needed to be compensated for, in order, and those developers needed to buy credits that need to come from somewhere else or an independent accreditation agency. But we are now the largest, we call it the habitat, we make conform habitat banks, and we are the largest provider of those habitat banks in the UK that then sells those credits to those developers. It's working well. It's a sizable and growing market. Upwards of £250 million a year is anticipated and could become £1 billion in a year in medium term. Why is that relevant for Australia? Australia is a very important, has very important ambitions within the sustainability agenda, the 2035, 2050. Biodiversity is a big contributor to that. And therefore, what can the government do to catalyze biodiversity regeneration or mitigate the loss that's going on? And will it have developments for things like battery storage, for example? So supply side reform from the government. So the government stepping in and evolving the nature repair mechanism to something where it becomes mandatory through an act that developers have to offset their biodiversity loss through credits like we have in the UK is important. Indeed, in the UK, it's biodiversity net gain. You have to offset plus 10%. So if you offset, let's call it 100 units, you have to achieve 110 units worth of biodiversity regeneration. So I think this is something that Australia is a very powerful force for sustainability. And this is definitely an area which I hope the government will pick up over here and start running with.
I mean, that's one type of, I guess, government intervention that you've talked on there. But I mean, what about a biodiversity fund in Australia? Do you think, I mean, obviously the Future Fund has several sub-funds. It has a future healthcare fund, the drought fund. Do you think it should possibly look to investing through one to rehabilitate parts of arid Australia?
Yeah, I think there's many components of biodiversity and sustainability within natural capital. Afforestation, we're a big player in afforestation, particularly in WA at the moment. And, you know, that's a big component. Biodiversity is a big component. Water mitigation rights is also another big component. So each of these areas are significant components. And the government, not necessarily having subsidising, but putting in supply-side reform so that, you know, those people that are creating the loss need to offset that. And I think that example I gave you about in the UK, making it mandatory, which is the only mandatory regulated market in the world for biodiversity, is an important one. And there we can all learn from where areas where things have worked, things haven't worked. At the moment, that's working in the UK. Battery storage, you know, we've had that 7 or 8 years. There are areas to learn from us. You know, the interaction between the grid operator and those people putting in the capital for new renewables and battery storage is critical. And I think that is, they are learnings that we should have.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for sharing your insights and your outlook for these asset classes or emerging asset classes with us. Thanks again for joining us on The Green Away.
It's good to be here, Jamie. Thank you.
The Green Away podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.